It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 911 for the 13th of December, 2024. This week, text messages on our phones are so easy to use and so common that it's all too easy to forget how useful they are to scammers. Every text message should be treated with suspicion. In short circuits, recently I needed to format a 64-gigabyte thumb drive using FAT32, one of the older formatting types. The Windows formatting tool won't allow it, so maybe you think the FAT32 limit is 32 gigabytes. It's not, and formatting the large drive turned out to be refreshingly easy. And sometimes I wonder if Tim Berners-Lee or Mark Andreessen had any idea in the late 1980s and early 1990s that the browsers they were developing to view simple text files would expand and virtually take over the world. Scammers like messaging systems that are provided by your phone carrier. They are using both the older SMS protocol as well as the newer RCS protocol. Your cellular service provider may catch some of the scams and issue a warning, but they won't catch all of the scams. The messaging systems seem so simple and easy to use that it's hard to think of them as threat vectors, but they are. They're simple and easy for scammers, too. And they use them for all the standard ploys. Messaging services are used to send phishing messages that appear to be from legitimate companies, trying to trick users into providing sensitive information like bank account details or credit card numbers. They can be used for identity theft and personal information harvesting, leading to victimization, unauthorized account access, fraudulent loans, and other financial products made in the victim's name. Malware distribution is also possible. Infected attachments can be included with RCS messages, and links to malicious sites can be sent with either type of message. Scammers use social engineering tactics to manipulate victims into taking actions they normally wouldn't, such as sharing sensitive information or clicking on harmful links. These efforts are often enhanced through an emphasis on urgency. You'll see messages that I received on two consecutive days on the TechBiter Worldwide website. They illustrate a couple of the problems. A message claiming to be from Amazon said my account balance had been adjusted and told me to use a link to log in if I wanted to inquire. This message was so obvious that Google had already tagged it as a suspected spam. There are lots of clues. As far as I know, Amazon doesn't use RCS messaging to communicate with customers. If they did, the message would come from a corporate server located at Amazon's headquarters. The message I received came from a number located in Northeast Oklahoma. That's not where Amazon is. Had the message been from Amazon, it would have addressed me by name and would have referred to a specific transaction using an ID number. Oh, and I don't run an account with Amazon, so there is no account for which a balance might have been adjusted. What's the scammer looking for? This could be an attempt to obtain my username and password, so the scammer could then place orders using my name and bank account information. That's probably the most likely explanation, but it could also have been an attempt to install malware on the computer or phone. Needless to say, I did not click the link. One day later, I received another message from Oklahoma. Different area code, but still in Oklahoma. This one didn't claim to be from Amazon, but said it was attempting to confirm an order I had placed. If I didn't call them back immediately, they would ship the order and charge me for it. Well, I hadn't ordered anything from Oklahoma, and had the message been legitimate, it would have specified what items were in the order and their cost. It also wouldn't sound like it was written by somebody who's 9 years old and not doing well in English class. The scammer is almost certainly looking for a credit card number. You didn't order anything from us, they would say. Well, we'll take care of that for you right away. And then they would ask for enough information to be able to use my credit or debit card to make a purchase. You won't be surprised to learn that I did not call the number. Protective applications from your cellular service provider, or protective applications that you've installed on your phone, might help, but it's really up to us users to be the final part of the firewall. Be skeptical and always verify the sender's identity before responding to messages or clicking any links. And if you're interested in the differences between short message service, SMS, and rich communications service, RCS, here's a quick look. Both are messaging protocols used for sending text messages. SMS is a simple text messaging service that limits text messages to 160 characters, and there is no support for multimedia content or any advanced features. RCS is an enhanced messaging protocol that's an extension of Multimedia Messaging Service, or MMS. It supports group chats, high-resolution photo and video sharing, read receipts, typing indicators, and more. SMS has largely been replaced by MMS, and both are being supplanted by RCS with its array of useful features. The sole advantage SMS might have is its ability to work with only a cellular connection. Both MMS and RCS require an internet connection, so RCS is found only on smartphones that can handle mobile data and Wi-Fi connections. One disadvantage RCS has that it is not yet universally supported. Both the sender and the receiver must have RCS-compatible devices with compatible services enabled by their carriers. RCS messages can be encrypted, but not all are. SMS messages are not encrypted, so any information shared by SMS could be vulnerable. Overall, SMS is a basic text messaging service with limited capabilities, and RCS offers a lot more features but requires an internet connection. The bottom line here, though, is this. Both can be exploited by thieves. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In short circuits, the audio system in my car, which is a 2009 Honda Fit, can play CDs, and there's also an option to plug in a USB thumb drive. I primarily use the USB option, but the drive has to be formatted as FAT32. If you want to use a larger thumb drive, you're out of luck because Windows won't format a 64GB drive as FAT32. Or are you out of luck? In fact, you're not. Windows won't format a 64GB drive as FAT32, but that doesn't mean you can't do it. And just because my old car won't recognize a 64GB drive formatted as extended FAT doesn't mean I can't use it in the car. Given the events of the 5th of November, I felt the need for more calm and relaxing music in the car, even though I no longer spend very much time driving to an office, and I have no planned transcontinental trips on the agenda, but I wanted to be cautious. There is a misconception that drives larger than 32GB cannot be formatted as FAT32. Well, that's wrong. FAT32 works just fine with larger drives. Microsoft simply doesn't provide an option to do it. FAT32 has a theoretical volume size limit of 16 terabytes. Yeah, 16 terabytes. And the current practical limit is 8 terabytes, which is far larger than any currently manufactured thumb drive. If Honda had possessed the foresight to design its audio system to use devices formatted as XFAT or NTFS, this wouldn't have been a problem. But if Honda had possessed the foresight to design its audio system to deal with known issues that would affect systems in and after 2022, I wouldn't be dealing with a clock that's wrong by an hour most of the year. So we deal with what we have, and that's a Honda deficiency combined with a Microsoft deficiency. There's really nothing wrong with FAT32. It's old. It was created for floppy disk storage for Windows 95, but it is still commonly used for memory cards and flash drives. It isn't as efficient as newer systems such as Extended FAT and NTFS. The main shortcoming is that you can't save individual files over 4 gigabytes in size, and you can't make a partition over 8 terabytes in size. But if you have a 64-gigabyte thumb drive, you won't be creating any partitions larger than the drive itself, and it's unlikely that an audio file, or even a porno movie, will be larger than 4 gigabytes. So why won't Microsoft allow users to format a 64-gigabyte thumb drive as FAT32? Well, actually, in fact, they will, but you have to know how to ask in the right way. There are two ways to format a drive larger than 32 gigabytes as FAT32. One involves using the command line, slow and likely to fail, and the other uses a free downloadable utility, which is fast and usually works just fine. I will explain how you can do this with the command line, but I strongly recommend downloading FAT32 format because you can navigate to the website, download the file, run it, and format the drive in far less time than it takes to use the command line option. You'll find a link to where you can download FAT32 format on the TechBiter Worldwide website. If you prefer to try the command line option, insert a thumb drive and close all instances of File Explorer or any application that may access the drive. Then press the Windows key and X, choose Terminal, Admin, and type this command, format /fs:FAT32, and then the drive letter. Press Enter to proceed. If any Explorer function is active, you'll see a warning. Give the process permission to force a demount of the drive after you've made absolutely certain that the thumb drive is the letter you've specified. Now, this process may take 20 to 30 minutes. In the case I illustrate on the TechBiter Worldwide website, time to completion was 28 minutes, and the process failed. Thanks, Microsoft. Seriously, don't bother with this process. Just download FAT32 format. You don't even have to install it. Just run it, select the appropriate drive letter, and proceed. The formatting process will be complete in about 5 seconds. Yeah, 5 seconds. And then you'll have a 64-gigabyte thumb drive formatted as FAT32. Don't try to save any files larger than 4 gigabytes to the drive. Otherwise, use it exactly the way you would any similar Extended FAT or NTFS drive. Browsers have advanced a lot since the days of Netscape Navigator, or if you're old enough and had exactly the right connections in the 1980s, Tim Berners-Lee's Nexus, which began life as World Wide Web. Regardless of which browser you used first, it's likely nothing like what we have now. Today's browsers have tabs, extensions, and features intended to make them easier for people to use. Many have protective features built in. Unlike in the early days, we can count on just about any browser to properly display just about any web page. Your preferred browser almost certainly has some features that you haven't noticed, though. And that's not a put-down. Missing a feature on a browser is roughly equivalent to missing a grain of sand on a beach. So many exist that you simply can't enumerate all of them. But there are a few features that are relatively common across browsers and can improve your experience, particularly if you're somebody who has several sites open simultaneously, or maybe several dozen. I once thought the 23 sites that I open every morning with Vivaldi was excessive, but some people open more than 100 sites when they start their browser. Browsers can handle the load if the computer has enough memory. Most modern browsers try to address the memory issue by allowing tabs that you haven't used for a while to simply doze off. The memory used by the sleeping tabs is released for use by other applications, but the browser will have to reload the site when you open the tab. You can adjust this if you want to keep some or all tabs from sleeping. Chrome-based browsers will have a memory saver function in settings. This controls when the tabs doze off, and it applies to all tabs. The default setting is automatic. You can disable it or set all tabs to sleep after they've been idle for a specific period. Vivaldi's options are 1, 2, 3, and 6 hours. Microsoft Edge is naturally different from all other Chrome browsers. The functionality is the same, but the wording differs. Firefox is the least adjustable. The function is on by default, and you can turn it off only by digging into the Developers menu and setting browser.tabs.unload on low memory to false. If you have a specific tab that you want to reload frequently and never sleep, try right-clicking the tab. You might find options to reload the tab as often as once a minute. Here's another useful feature. Maybe you closed a tab accidentally. Then you thought, oh, I didn't mean to close that tab. And then you had to type the URL again and navigate to the area that was open. Or worse, you can't remember the URL because it came from a search engine, and you haven't set the search engine to open links in a new tab, and the search engine is closed along with your query. Did you know you can undo close? This works with most browsers, on Windows or Mac. On Windows, press Ctrl-Shift-T. On a Mac, Command-Shift-T. And if you forget that, try right-clicking the tab list to see if the browser has implemented a reopen function on the context menu. And here's one more. You know Windows has a task manager, but so does your browser. The Windows task manager can kill the entire browser process, but the browser's task manager can kill individual processes being run by the browser. Use this power with caution. To open the task manager in Chrome-based browsers, even Edge, right-click on any blank area of the interface, not a blank area in a web page, but a blank area somewhere on the interface, and then choose the task manager option from the context menu. For Firefox, you have to type about:performance in the address bar. This is a good way to examine memory, CPU, and network resources that are used by various pages. Perhaps of more importance is the fact that you'll see what system resources are being used by any extensions you've installed. So if the browser seems slow, this is an easy way to look under the hood and see if something is misbehaving. It's surprising how many features and how much power have been added to browsers in the past 40 years. I sometimes wonder if Tim Berners-Lee or Mark Andreessen had any idea how much would be added to the simple tools they created. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.